Recent incidents involving the American intelligence gathering ships Liberty and Pueblo have called attention once again to the worldwide implications of the espionage establishment, as it has been called, a field that by its very nature is often obscure from public view. Is it a threat to our basic liberties? Does it help to ward off the possibility of war, or can it be a contributing factor? Tonight, a Newsfront special on spying, with the man who headed the super-secret Central Intelligence Agency. He is Alan Dulles, head of the CIA from 1953 to 1961, active in government service from 1916 on, head of OSS operations in Switzerland during World War II, and for the years between the wars, a practicing attorney. Mr. Dulles is the author of The Secret Surrender, The Craft of Intelligence, and the editor of the newly published anthology, Great True Spy Stories. Mr. Dulles, can intelligence be a threat to our very peace and security?
No, I don't think it really can be if it's properly controlled, and properly organized, and properly carried out. It can be, I think, a great benefit to the security of the United States.
I think that when the USS Pueblo was captured just a little bit more than a month ago, many Americans said, well, if that ship hadn't been there at that time, then this incident would not have occurred, and the grave repercussions that could stem from it might not occur. What is your view of that statement?
Well, my view of that is this, that it is very important to get the type of intelligence that a ship like the Pueblo can gather. Therefore, it was reasonable that it should be in that general area in order to carry out its mission. Obviously, it is important to know what the possible antagonist is planning and doing and so forth and so on. One of the ways is to pick up from the airwaves, you know, what he's saying.
Of course, there is a point, is there not, when the risk outweighs the possible advantages of the intelligence operation?
Well, if these ships did go into territorial waters, but there's no reason why they should, and I have no reason to believe that they did. I mean, every great power has instrumentalities of intelligence collection of this nature and is engaged in doing it.
When the U-2 plane was shot down, you were in the intelligence establishment.
That's
at
right.
That time, there was a great outcry that that plane shouldn't have been there at that time, that it scuttled the Paris conference.
Well, one always can say that, but if one stops gathering intelligence because someday something should be a little bit out of place, you wouldn't be doing anything. You can't. You ought to be careful, of course, not to be in places where there's great danger, but you can't always avoid that. Danger is inherent in life.
Yes. Well, you take the recent incidents of these American intelligence ships and the Russian trawlers that have been so active in waters around the United States and elsewhere in the world. Some have said that perhaps the two countries could establish a mutual agreement whereby they would not need to engage in this, that after all, these countries were spying on each other and clocking their activities. Why do this if some international agency could police this?
Well, you couldn't get an international agency that would collect intelligence for its various members. I don't think that would be really a feasible thing to do. And if you're going to collect intelligence, you have to use the instrumentalities that are best equipped to do it. Obviously, over a period of time, whether it happens to be a U-2 airplane or whether it happens to be a ship with certain equipment, all great nations of the world are engaged in gathering intelligence. And especially in this nuclear missile age, it is very vitally important that we have as clear as possible information as to the capabilities and intentions of a potential enemy.
Let me just ask you this. From a psychological standpoint, though, the implications of knowing that the Soviet Union, for instance, is intensively engaged in infiltrating our society, and that we, by the same token, are intensively engaged in infiltrating Soviet society. Doesn't this contribute to developing even more of a lack of trust in each other?
No, I don't think it does, because it seems to me that precise knowledge of the other situation gives one a sense of security. If for today we did not have certain knowledge of what the capabilities of the Soviet were, was, for example, in the missile field, I think we'd be in a period of uncertainty, unrest, insecurity. And I think good intelligence as to where the opponent stands, what he's doing, what his capabilities are, ought to lead to additional security rather than insecurity.
So you're in favor of more spying, not less?
No, I don't say that I'm in favor of more than is being done, but I think that one has to do enough to know what the position of a great potential enemy may be in the missile field and in all other related fields.
It's not possible to conceive of countries like the United States and the Soviet Union voluntarily providing the information that would lead to the security of each party in the world.
Well, I don't think one could ever be sure that the other power was doing just that. Theoretically, that might be an excellent idea, but that would mean we'd put ourselves in their hands, in a sense. They would hand us a blueprint, let us say, of their missile situation. How do we know that's correct? It should only be by testing it out, by finding out ourselves, that we would know whether any such disposition, any such showing that they might make, was the true showing.
Well, do I imply from what you say that even in an era of international inspection, let's talk about disarmament if this were ever to occur, that even in an era where there was an international inspection agreement, that you feel that espionage would still be warranted and necessary to check on the information being presented?
Well, if that agreement were a completely effective agreement and led to the result you suggest, that would be a different thing. But you never can be sure of that unless you have your own methods of seeing whether it is correct, testing out what they give you. Now, I doubt whether such an agreement is possible. In the first place, as far as the Soviet Union is concerned, they have refused anything of that kind. You remember President Eisenhower proposed the open skies, which I think was a very good idea, that we'd each be able to look down and see what the other fellow was doing. They rejected that.
What about the whole relationship of espionage to the individuals involved? And again, when there is an espionage revelation, the hue and cry is that this is not only something that is dangerous and undemocratic, as we know our American society, but that the rights of the human beings involved are secondary to the information that's gathered. That the men of the Pueblo, for instance, may have engaged in their mission, whatever it was, and they will now perhaps be sacrificed to whatever fate they may face.
I'm afraid that is inherent in the business. Now, as far as my experience goes, one would not ask a man to do anything that he was unwilling to do or did unwillingly or did reluctantly. He wouldn't be a good agent. He wouldn't be useful to you if that was the way he approached his job. I don't know of a case in my own experience where I ever asked a man to do something of this kind that he didn't want to do. Or if I felt he was reluctant to do the kind of work that he was in, I would find someone else. So this situation doesn't really arise. The kind of people that you have, they know they're going into a difficult and maybe a dangerous occupation. And just like the military man who's sent to the front, they go willingly.
Well, you take the Pueblo again, if I may, since
yes,
it's
surely.
The most recent incident. The outcry in this country following the capture of that ship was that we should go in with military force, recapture it, and bring the men back. It was engaged.
Well, we didn't do it.
No, we didn't. Do you
think
we right should?
We didn't do it. No, I don't think we should. I don't think that the agent that is sent in expects any military power to follow him up if he gets into difficulty. I don't think he should. Of course, I speak, as you know, I'm a private citizen. It's been some years since I retired from the Central Intelligence Agency. So as I talk to you here today and as we discuss these things together, I'm just giving you my own personal impressions and not any official viewpoint or any official knowledge.
The use of blackmail in intelligence. Over the years, we've read numerous stories, although I must admit in your book, very true spy stories, it does not appear that often. But is this not a major tool that's used to bring agents into the fold to get information by whatever means possible?
It has been used, there's no doubt about that. I don't really believe much in the use of it, but it has been used in the past, probably will be used in the future. You hope that the agents that you have will not be subject to blackmail, but that can always arise and has arisen, and there are many cases, some in this book that I've just written that you referred to.
You talk about the ideal agent. He's a likable chap.
One presses for the ideal.
You said that Klaus Fuchs was a rather of a bore, even though he performed his mission very well.
Well, Klaus Fuchs was a very fine agent from the Soviet point of view, and did his job extremely well from the Soviet point of view. He was one of the most unfortunate, from our point of view, is one of the most unfortunate incidents in our history.
Yes. Well, what is the ideal agent? How would you describe him?
I tried to do it in the introduction to these spy stories, and I was saying that the ideal agent is the agent who, first of all, is able to get valuable information of a strategic importance to the United States. A man who, in doing that, conducts himself with skill and discretion, and who is able to decide what is important, what is unimportant. An ideal agent is an ideal collector of vital information. Now, you don't always have to steal something to do it. Sometimes you can get it by very technical means, and sometimes you get it just by cleverness as an individual. But the purpose of intelligence is to get important information.
And the means is secondary to the end.
Well, the means, he must use the means that are best adapted to do that. And generally, the exotic means that we often think of, the James Bond means, are not necessarily the best way of getting information.
Hasn't intelligence work changed greatly in the last few years, even in the years since you've been with the agency, with the great increase in the technical methodology, the electronics, and other devices?
Yes, that is very true. Because those devices were very largely developed because we found that the ordinary agent, traveling on foot with his notebook and so forth, couldn't get to the places and couldn't see the things that were vital to be known. And today we would not have, in the field of our knowledge with regard to the Soviet development of guided missiles and so forth, we wouldn't have anything like the information we desire. Unless we had been able to develop these technical means of getting to the proper place to see what you want to see.
Doesn't this mean that the agent himself, the individual, the human being, is less important than he was as a spy, as a member of the intelligence establishment?
Well, it only means that you are giving the agent the tools that he needs to do his job. And then, of course, you have the other side of intelligence, the analysis of the information. The information is of no value unless it's properly analyzed and unless it gets to the proper people at the proper time. And so you can't do away with the human element, even if we had all the gadgets that you can possibly think of.
Let's spend a moment looking at the Central Intelligence Agency, for example, the vast organization in Washington, pictures of which show a complex that is perhaps larger than any other government installation.
No, well, go ahead.
Almost, perhaps. Well, in any event, what makes up this establishment? What goes into this? They're certainly not all spies in Washington.
Oh, and by no means. Of course, the definition of a spy, that's another thing. We won't get into that right now. We may get to that later. But there are a certain number of people, and quite a good number, not nearly as many generally as is advertised, but people who are trained to deal with facts, people who have the judgment to, under guidance, of course, to know what to go and what to collect and how to go about doing it. And they're given general guidance, of course. In my experience, it has always been when you have given an agent a pretty precise objective that you have had success. I remember what I thought was one of the most important things that I accomplished was getting a speech, the famous speech of Khrushchev, when he denigrated Stalin. And you remember he made a very, back in 56, I believe it was, made a speech in which he described Stalin as a very cruel dictator.
This was at a secret meeting of the...
it was a meeting, yes, of the Supreme Soviet. And the Soviet never gave out the text of that speech. We knew that the speech was important, very vitally important, but the Soviet Union never published the full text. They gave us little pieces of it, but we knew it was so important that then...
Now,
this became
it?
The target. What?
How did you get it?
Well, that I can't tell you. But we made this a major target. And we decided that certain people would likely have seen that speech because they were at this meeting of the Supreme Soviet. There were several hundred people anyway, maybe many of the thousand present. And they heard the speech. And we knew who would probably have it. Because it was such a long speech that it was clear that this speech must be on paper. Khrushchev had read it. It was clear that he was reading his speech. Even he, with his extraordinary memory, Khrushchev was very, very good as far as extempore speaking. But he couldn't have done this extempore. This must have been from a text. Now, where was the text? And we finally found the text. And then it was published in full by the New York Times, given to the State Department. The New York Times published it in full. And there were so many people present that heard this speech that the Soviet Union never was able to deny it.
Probably never found out how you got it either, I suspect.
I hope not.
Yes. Well, you mentioned the word spy. I mentioned the word spy before. And
yes.
You said you wanted to say something about the use of the term spy. And,
Well, I think the difficulty is that a spy has become a little bit a term of opprobrium, I think. Most of the people that are sometimes generally called spies are ordinary individuals with a certain amount of training, a certain amount of background, who are taught to gather information on specific subjects assigned to them. Of course, in time of war, we know the spy has to go behind the lines. He risks his life. The spy is caught. He's executed. And it's a very dangerous thing. But in ordinary time of peace, one sends out information gatherers. Now, you can call them spies if you want. People do call them spies. I'd like to speak of intelligence operations rather than spy operations because there's something about the word spy that repels a little bit. It's too bad in a way, I think, because many spies have been very brave people, risked their lives for their country.
You don't use the spyglass anymore, I suspect.
It came from that. A spyglass came from that. Yeah. Exactly the way you could get information
that
you couldn't get with the human eye because you needed to.
Mr. Dulles, let's go back for a moment to the recent revelations within the past 2 years of what was referred to as the underwriting by the Central Intelligence Agency of many foundations and organizations engaged in international activities. This received, of course, tremendous publicity and was sensational when it first hit the papers. In looking back, do you feel that that this was, in a sense, counterproductive because of the adverse publicity and the doubt and suspicion that has since accrued to those who were involved?
Well, I think one has to look at the situation as it existed in those days, in the 50s, at the time of the takeover of Czechoslovakia. At the time when the Soviet were threatening to take over Berlin, at the time when all of these great student festivals that were being held by the Soviet, they were luring students to the Soviet, and they were holding meetings of students there. Nothing was being done. The American position wasn't being presented. They, of course, poured out millions and millions of rubles in order to finance these great meetings that they held in at first they were generally they were only held behind the Iron Curtain, either in East Berlin or in Prague or in places where they had really control of the media of communication.
But then the situation changed. Do you think this continued a bit too long? Perhaps that was the problem with it after the environment had changed somewhat.
Well, maybe I'd put it another way. I think that because we were able to take countermeasures, and they found some of these things, the Soviet found some of these things they were doing unproductive because of these countermeasures, they changed their policy. I'm not at all sure they would if we'd done nothing about it. I'm not at all sure they would have changed. But they found that when their actions in the way they handled these student conferences and convocations and meetings, the way they handled them, the way they tried to utilize them for their own purposes, that they found, when it was disclosed, when it was openly shown what they were doing, then they found it counterproductive, and they haven't been doing it.
As far as we're concerned, it's now over.
Well, I don't say that by... I don't by any means think the Cold War is over. I think the Pueblo incident and a great many other incidents that have happened recently shows we can't yet say the Cold War is over. But certainly in many fields, the Soviet activities are somewhat different now than they were 20, 30 years ago.
Mr. Dulles, very briefly, would you recommend a career for a young person in the CIA?
Well, I've had that question up often because people come to me and they ask me whether they should go into this and to tell them a little bit about it, and I try to help them on that. I don't discourage. No, I think that our country needs this, and if it needs it, it must find the people to do it and do it right.
Well, thank you, Alan Dulles.
Thank you.
Our interview with Alan Dulles was pre-recorded late yesterday. Mr. Dulles, as you recall, was the head of the Central Intelligence Agency from 1953 to 1961. He is the author, in addition to editing the anthology Great True Spy Stories, Mr. Dulles is the author of two books, The Craft of Intelligence and The Secret Surrender, which details the surrender of German forces in Italy in World War II.